Senators. My name is Rich Bolton, and I actually don't have a Colorado state bar number. My Wisconsin bar number is 101-2552. My co-counsel is Dan Bonifazi from the Bonifazi and Hindewish law firm. Bar number or not?
Your Honor, my bar number is 30645.
And Mr. Bolton, I assume you've been admitted pro hoc vice for purposes of this case?
I was in the trial court. I don't know if I was typically pro hoc. I don't know if I needed it for...
The clerk tells me you have been, so...
Okay.
Okay. Thank you. You may proceed.
Okay, thank you. Your Honor, the basic issue in this case relates to a concept that, particularly in 2012, everybody's familiar with, and that is the concept of endorsement. Now, the reason I say people are familiar with that already is that in this year of a presidential election, the concept of seeking endorsements and by that process attempting to benefit from the prestige and credibility of the endorser is something that is very common in life, and it's particularly common during the year of a presidential election. Certainly, we've been going through that very extensively in the last couple of days in Wisconsin with our primary coming up. The issue in this case, however, deals with the concept of endorsement in a different context, and that is governors' proclamations of a Colorado Day of Prayer that are issued, have been issued at least since 2004 annually by the governor. They're official proclamations. They bear the governor's official executive seal and signature. The reason, and basically, as we are told by the government, these proclamations originate from a request from an organization called the National Day of Prayer Task Force. Now, one of the critical things, and the reason, and the undisputed reason that that these proclamations, these official proclamations, are requested by this particular entity, which is an organization that is evangelical in its orientation, and are attempting to mobilize the general public to engage in prayer and basically participate in religious activities.
Pardon, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Pardon me for interrupting, Mr. Bolton, if I may, please. But the record indicates that your organization also, at least in 2005, requested a proclamation. And the proclamation was giving, for example, Free Thought Week, or giving thanks for State Church Separation Week. Do you know what happened with your 2005 request?
You know, I'm going to apologize. I don't know. My recollection is that there was not a proclamation, but I don't want to commit. I honestly don't know the answer to that question.
So I guess my question is, if you request and you're asking for Free Thought Week or giving thanks for State Church Separation Week, what does that say about the request made by the National Day of Prayer Task Force?
Right. And that's one of the principal arguments that that the governor makes in this case, that the fact that the endorsements, the result basically upon request, is a significant factor. And the implication is that that a public forum has been created, and that if you don't give a, that if you give proclamations, and the governor argues at great length that there are other proclamations, secular proclamations that are issued, and if you're going to issue upon request secular proclamations, then you also have to engage in proclamations of that endorse religious agendas as well.
Well, Mr. Bolton, let me just ask you this. You're talking about an endorsement, but I know that the governor is saying that this is just a mere recognition or an acknowledgement and not an endorsement. Can you address if there's any difference in what it is?
Yes, I think there. I don't believe it is. These proclamations are being requested. the endorsement, and I'll use the term, the request for the proclamation is being requested by the organization, not simply as an acknowledgement, but in order to acquire the credibility and prestige of the official proclamation, in order to help mobilize around an event. And so what we're doing is the proclamation is being requested and then used to promote a religious event, which is quite different than simply the acknowledgement, the historical acknowledgement of religion. We're dealing with something that is being solicited, much like in politics, people may solicit, you know, endorsements. The governor's proclamation is being requested precisely not for its acknowledgement purposes, but for the credibility that it adds to their event.
But under the Lemon test, the first prong is, what's the purpose of it? So whose purpose should we be looking at? Do we look at the purpose of the requester, or do we look at the purpose of the government to find out if it's constitutional or unconstitutional or not? Well, you seem to be saying we look at the purpose of the requester, but what evidence is there in the record that the government here had a religious purpose in issuing this proclamation as opposed to a secular purpose?
The secular motivation issue, the first test of the or factor in the Lemon test, is really not at issue. The Supreme Court has said that in order for that to be a factor, the government's sole motivation has to be to promote religion. And here the governor says, I'm basically giving these proclamations, these endorsements upon request, as in fact he would say, without much thought at all, in order to sort of enhance my base with the citizens. The question of the intent and why they're being requested and how they're being used arises under the second, the endorsement and the effect of giving the appearance of religious endorsement. So in terms of, I think that motivation for which the proclamation is being requested and used is very relevant under the principal effect test of the Lemon.
Well, let me expand my question a little bit and ask you a little bit about the procedural context of this case and what's before us and what isn't before us. As I read what happened in the trial court and what's happened here is that each side is taking a polarized view. It's either all or nothing. But we have several different proclamations, one issued in each of several years, and they're not the same. The facts surrounding them, the context surrounding them are not the same. Some included this theme message, some didn't. One year you actually had the governor going out on the Capitol steps and speaking. So should we be analyzing this case on a proclamation by proclamation basis, each one separately, given what the facts are, or is it an all or nothing?
I think in terms of the proclamations that are before the court, including those that that included a specific religious biblical reference in the proclamations, which was only discontinued for 2 years after the lawsuit was filed, and there's certainly the governor's has never made any indication that there's an intention to not resume that, and in fact the proclamation in 2011 did in fact again include the biblical theme requested by the National Day of Prayer Task Force. But even those that don't, I think you're looking at something, you're looking at proclamations that they're not simply declaring an acknowledgement of a historical fact. They are proclaiming for the state, each and every one of them says, I hereby declare such and such a day to be the Colorado Day of Prayer. They're declaring an event, and it is an event that is of religious significance. Prayer is inherently religious, and so you're not talking about simply again, a proclamation that is merely acknowledging a historical event. All of these proclamations are being solicited for the purpose not of acknowledging a historical fact, but are being solicited in order to acquire the oomph of the governor's official proclamation in terms of their own proselytizing activities. So I don't think you need to look at them on a one-by-one basis. Certainly all that we have before us are being used precisely to promote a religious event. And the fact that they're requested does not change the fact that they constitute government speech. There's no argument, for instance, in another context, the issue of various vanity license plates, where the question arises, are we dealing with private speech or government speech? There's no claim here that we're dealing with anything other than government speech. These are proclamations that are issued officially by the governor. And with government speech, unlike private speech, is prohibited by the no preference clause under the Colorado Constitution from being used to endorse and enhance and to promote religion. Now, the district judge was influenced by the fact that, but even so, no one's forced to do anything.
Let me ask you a question about the district court's opinion. Again, to try to give some context to what our role as an appellate court is. Under the Lemon test, you have the purpose prong, you have the effect prong, and here you have the trial court saying in its order, well, I find the purpose is this, and I find the effect is that. Is that a question of fact to which we should defer if there is evidence in the record, or is that a legal conclusion on each of those prongs, given that this case is presented to us on summary judgment, right, not after a trial?
You know, let me respond in two ways. First of all, I think it's a legal question because basically the district court is drawing inferences from basic facts. His inference that these are mere acknowledgement was an inference from the raw facts that these are being requested and they're being used in this particular purpose. The other answer to your question is this: the parties agreed that they would submit the case on a written record, and so the judge and in fairness to him, we compounded the made things more complicated. We agreed to submit it on a written record, so he decided it as a summary judgment motion. But quite frankly, the parties agreed to have it submitted. In that situation, in terms of the inferences, the facts before the court, and the inferences to draw that can be drawn from the facts, basically you are in the same position as the district court. So, and I think in our appellate briefs, both parties are in agreement that basically this is the de novo standard of review. What I started to allude to is this: the district judge felt that there was no coercion, and I want to emphasize that with under the no preference clause, coercion is not required. In the context of a free exercise claim, coercion is required. But for instance, as we know from Crash and Menorah cases and the recent case in the federal court with the highway crosses, it isn't required under the Establishment Clause or the No Preference Clause that there be coercion. And here, the parties that are bringing the lawsuit do have standing. Under Colorado's standing rules, the courts have repeatedly emphasized that Colorado follows a broad rule of standing. And in this particular case, the individuals involved are people who are affected, who have an effect. They all have an interest in a government that does not promote religion. And that provision, the no preference clause of the Constitution, is a self-executing clause. And the Colorado appellate courts and the Supreme Court has said that with self-executing Supreme Court or constitutional provisions that there is standing, particularly where you're dealing with people who are non-believers, who are felt to make as if they're outsiders and excluded as a result of this. So
thank you, Mr. Bolton.
I didn't reserve any time, and so hopefully I've addressed all of your questions, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bolton.
May it please the court. My name is Matthew Grove, registration number 34269. I'm here on behalf of the defendants in this case, the state of Colorado, and Governor John Hickenlooper. I'd like to begin discussing something that Mr. Bolton touched on at the end of his argument, and that is the nature of the injury that's been alleged in this case, and the related question, whether the plaintiffs have standing to sue. This case presents a good opportunity for this court to follow up on its opinion in Hodling versus Hickenlooper and further clarify that the injury in fact requirement that was established by the Supreme Court in 1977 in Wimberley versus Edinburgh still applies to cases that are not based on an allegation of taxpayer standing. Supreme Court precedent on the difference between taxpayer standing and citizen standing and the injury in fact that's required under those two scenarios hasn't always been entirely straightforward, but in recent years, I think that we've started to see more clarity on the issue.
Pardon me for interrupting, if I may, Mr. We can affirm on other grounds, and we could include, couldn't we, particularly based on Conrad 1, that there was taxpayer standing in this case, don't you think?
If there had been an allegation that taxpayer funds were used, and actually we're at the summary judgment stage, so there would have to be more than a simple allegation. If there had been an allegation and evidence that taxpayer funds were associated with the governor's issuance of the honorary proclamations, then I would agree with you.
Isn't there such evidence in the record concerning the salaries of the workers who worked there, the amount of money used for postage to send these out, and the server space used to store these?
In my view, the Colorado Constitution requires more than that. Taxpayer standing requires an actual demonstrable showing of something other than fixed overhead costs that the government incurs on a daily basis.
But what case supports that principle?
There actually hasn't been much law on this in Colorado because taxpayer standing generally is so broad that the normally a taxpayer has to simply show that he has to make a showing that government funds have actually been expended. So let's take Barber v. Ritter. That's probably the best example. In that case, the allegation was that individuals who paid money into the state's cash funds, those are fee-based, that those were being misallocated by the legislature to contribute towards the state's general fund budget. Those individuals were actually able to make a demonstration that money that they had paid in was being dispersed in a way that they hadn't anticipated when they had paid the fees. So in that case, there was an actual showing that money was being shifted around. I'm not aware of any case law that specific to Colorado that discusses whether there's something more than a de minimis expenditure requirement that's associated with taxpayer standing.
Well, let me ask you a more general question about standing. If these particular plaintiffs, given who they are and what their beliefs are, don't have standing to challenge the constitutionality of these proclamations, who ever would?
Well, there are really two responses to that. First, the fact that someone doesn't necessarily have an opportunity, that there may not be an opportunity to challenge a government action, does not imply that the individuals who have actually brought the suit do. There's no guarantee under the Colorado Constitution or the federal Constitution that every single action that somebody disagrees with is going to be subject to judicial challenge. Second, I think that there are a lot of ways that the plaintiffs in this case, if they wanted to, could manufacture standing. The best example probably is what we've seen in federal jurisprudence, and this is not something that has come up under state law, is under the Establishment Clause, where a plaintiff is able to allege that he's suffered some kind of direct contact that has caused him a psychic injury.
But why should we force a plaintiff to have to go through personally which they find offensive just to give, as you said, manufacture standing in a particular case where there's a clear controversy here between two sides?
The general prudential requirement of standing requires a concrete adverseness that is only developed through, in the Establishment Clause or Preference Clause context, the direct sort of contact that someone can actually take offense at. The best example of this is likely the Valley Forge Christian College case from the U.S. Supreme Court in 1982, and it's actually very close to being on point to what we have here. In that case, the plaintiffs read about a land transfer that they believed was violated the Establishment Clause because it was between the federal government and a Christian organization. They read about it or they heard about it in media reports, and they filed suit saying, we believe that the federal government's action and their cooperation with or transaction with a religious organization violates the Establishment Clause. And the U.S. Supreme Court disagreed with that for the very reason that we're urging the court to disagree with the plaintiffs here, and that is that not having direct contact with the allegedly offending transaction was not sufficient for Article III standing.
But, Mr. Grove, if we'd had the same sort of standing jurisprudence as the United States Supreme Court, you would have a strong argument. But our standing rules, our Supreme Court has told us that our standing rules are significantly broader, and thus I don't know how helpful the authority is that you just provided to us.
I would agree with you in the taxpayer standing context. And if this were a taxpayer standing case, if there had been an allegation below that the state or the governor had expended some sort of tangible money in issuing these proclamations, then I don't think we would have much of an argument that taxpayer standing hadn't been established.
Mr. Grove, let me follow up on that, because what you're saying is there needs to be some proof of expenditure of government funds or taxpayer funds. And I'm looking at the Dodge case and Barber versus Ritter, and I don't see that those two cases are saying that. In fact, in Dodge, it says that it's an inquiry whether plaintiff taxpayer has averred a violation of specific constitutional provision. And in Barber v. Ritter, it's Colorado case law requires us to hold when a plaintiff taxpayer alleges that a government action violates a specific constitutional provision, such an averment satisfies the two-step standing analysis of Wimberley. So I'm having difficulty seeing where there's a requirement to show that taxpayer funds were expended.
That's the very nature of what taxpayer standing is. If you look back to U.S., our taxpayer standing jurisprudence derives from federal jurisprudence. I realize that it's broader, but I mean, Flast versus Cohen is probably the first case that really talks about this on the, that's on the municipal level, and then there are cases on the state and federal level. And all of them, the very basis of taxpayer standing is that there has been an unconstitutional expenditure of some sort. That's just the nature of the beast. There is no the difference between that and citizen standing is that under citizen standing, and this is the test that's laid out in Wimberley, is that there's actually an injury, that the individual who is alleging, who's raised the complaint, has suffered some sort of, in the Establishment Clause context, a direct contact with something that offends them.
Mr. Grove, if I may turn you to the merits, may I do so?
I was about to go there.
All right. I want to ask you a question about where this case sits on the following spectrum. On one hand, we have Marsh, in which the United States Supreme Court has told us that legislative prayers are constitutional under the Establishment Clause. On the other hand, we have cases like Lee and the Santa Fe School District case that say that public school prayers can be unconstitutional under the Establishment Clause of the United States Constitution. I am wondering, do we fit in the middle here somewhere? And if yes, why? And then last, how does this work with Justice Blackmun's footnote 52 in County of Allegheny, in which he specifically distinguishes between Marsh and the National Day of Prayer.
Wow, there are a lot of questions there. Let me start off by saying that where we fall on the spectrum is very dependent on the context. And that goes to Justice O'Connor's concurrence in Lynch versus Donnelly. And when we're dealing with school prayer cases, the context that is important in that case is the fact that it is very difficult, if not impossible, for someone who's required to attend class, who's required to sit in class, to avoid being exposed to a prayer that's led by a teacher or a principal or whoever. When we're dealing with the other end of the spectrum, we're not dealing with supposedly impressionable school children, but we're dealing with legislators who can step out of the chamber if they wish. There's no compulsory attendance for them. And who are also, I think the undercurrent in the Supreme Court's jurisprudence on this is that, you know, they're not subjects, they're not as impressionable. They're not, if they're offended by it, they're simply going to blow it off. And we are closer, I think, to the Marsh versus Chambers context in this case than we are to the Santa Fe School District. And the reason for that is that the very nature of honorary proclamations, as, and I can't remember the case off the top of my head, but I think it was Justice Stevens, or maybe Souter, wrote in one of the many Establishment Clause cases that are cited in the briefs, honorary proclamations by their nature are easily ignored. They're not publicly disseminated. They are just issued by chief executives to acknowledge events that go on. And the fact that they aren't shoved down the populace's throats, that they wouldn't have any force and effect of law, even if the governor attempted to do that, indicates that they're not the sort of, they don't have the sort of coercive impact or intent that the plaintiffs in this case have tried to assert exists here.
Let me ask a follow-up question, if I might. You based your argument somewhat on Marsh, and I'm trying to understand how, if at all, we as an intermediate appellate court can apply Marsh. We certainly have the United States Supreme Court saying in Marsh, well, we're going to use a different rationale than we've used before in Lemon. But our Supreme Court, and we're bound by our precedent, has said at least three times the Lemon test is what we look at when we're trying to judge the constitutionality under the preference clause of the Colorado Constitution. So do we have any ability whatsoever as an intermediate appellate court even to think about the Marsh analysis?
I think so, because the Lemon test has certainly been appropriate in the cases that have been presented to the Supreme Court has granted certiorari on. There have not been, as far as I know, any circumstances where Marsh, the application of Marsh would have been appropriate. What we're dealing with here, and the case law is very sparse, as you know, in the preference clause context under the Colorado Constitution. The three or four cases I can think off the top of my head are the Conrad case, which dealt with the nativity scene on the front steps of the City and County of Denver building. The Freedom from Religion's previous case, which was decided in 1996 and dealt with the Ten Commandments monument across the street from the Capitol. And so that was a monument case. And then there's one more that deals with the entanglement issue. It has to do with church-state relations and monetary contributions by the state. But there are no cases that deal with a sort of long-standing government practice that the historical practice test was designed to apply to. And I think the fact that the Supreme Court has not had an opportunity to decide that doesn't necessarily foreclose this court from applying the historical practice where it's appropriate. While I'm on the subject, I think that applying the historical practice in this test in this instance is very appropriate. And the reason for that is not because the record reflects that the governor's issuance of honorary proclamations or Thanksgiving proclamations or whatever type of proclamations dates back 100 years or 50 years or 75 years. But because the very nature of what an honorary proclamation is and the very source of it dates back to the very founding of the Republic. The first proclamation declaring a day of prayer was issued by George Washington, and it had been issued by virtually every president, granted Thomas Jefferson excepted, since then. And it's almost precisely the same sort of cascade of events that we see the Supreme Court approved in Marsh. And for that reason, we believe that the historical practice test is likely the most appropriate one for the court to apply in this case. And I see that my time is up, so we would ask that you affirm the district court's decision.
Thank you, Mr. Grove. Thank you to both counsel for your very helpful, excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted. The division will issue an opinion in due course.